Only at True North stores, new True Rewards members. Stack your savings at the pump. Sign up and earn 10 cents a gallon on your first fill-up. Second fill, get 20 cents off a gallon. Then earn a massive 30 cents off a gallon on your third fill-up. Join now. Find the True Rewards app in your favorite app store, download and click the star to sign up. Must be a new member of both True Rewards and Shell Fuel Rewards to qualify. Limit 20 gallons per fill. Additional terms apply. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
From the drone-filled skies over the Ukrainian frontline to the darkened, fuel-starved streets of Havana, the mechanisms of the global order are being violently rewritten. Welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana, and sitting across from me is my co-host, Kervin. And this week, we are unpacking a stunning reversal of fortunes and high-stakes diplomatic gambles. In Eastern Europe, the narrative of an inevitable Russian victory is collapsing as Kyiv exploits Moscow's communication blackouts and targets vital energy infrastructure deep behind enemy lines. Meanwhile, the shockwaves of the U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran continue to reverberate, forcing unlikely mediators like Pakistan to the table while Washington pitches a controversial 20-year nuclear freeze. And as Air Force One touches down in Beijing for a summit heavy on optics but completely light on actual ink, we are watching a delicate high-wire dance over Taiwanese sovereignty and global energy flows. Further south, we are tracking a massive geopolitical fault line opening in West Africa as the true epicenter of global terror shifts away from the Middle East. Finally, right in our own hemisphere, a maximum pressure campaign threatens to push the Cuban regime into a total, unmanaged collapse. Are we witnessing the calculated dismantling of authoritarian footholds, or just pushing fragile states toward catastrophic vacuums? Let's get into the state of play. We begin, as we do each week, with Ukraine, and read what is being said by people who have been on the front lines for years. The tone has completely changed. There's this palpable sense of Russian exhaustion right now.
Yeah, and I think the recent movements actually back that statement up. So for the first time in nearly 2 years, Ukraine is actually taking back more ground than they are losing. And it's not huge swaths of land. I want to be clear on that. But the trend has reversed.
Which really punctures that whole narrative Putin's been leaning on, right? This idea that a Russian victory is just a matter of time and the West should just throw in the towel.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right here. And that cognitive warfare strategy that Putin has been playing, it's really falling apart here. But what's really fascinating is why the tide is turning. It isn't because Ukraine suddenly got a flood of new tanks or some magic new weapons system. It's mostly because the Russian military is basically stumbling around in the dark. You see, their communications have completely broken down. And once they have lost illicit access to Starlink, you know, Elon Musk's network, Russian commanders were left relying on outdated maps and zero real-time coordination. So they tried to improvise with this massive, these massive visible antennas that they've set up, but Ukraine's just picked them off.
And then Moscow made it worse. I mean, the irony of the Kremlin banning Telegram to control their own civilians only to accidentally cut off their own soldiers' main way of talking to each other.
Yeah, like, this is very interesting. And you know very well, we've used Telegram to kind of track Russian mill bloggers so we can understand sort of the sentiment in Russia. So now Russia's cut that off, and this is a classic case of an authoritarian regime's domestic crackdown bleeding into their military effectiveness. And this is why authoritarian states typically don't fare well in long-term conflict. I think we're seeing this play out in real time because we have isolated Russian units who are just sitting out there, totally exposed, and Ukraine is just exploiting those blind spots.
But it's not like Ukrainian troops are just marching forward easily either. The front line is so packed with drones right now that nobody can really move.
Yeah, look, the physical battlefield is almost completely paralyzed at this point. That's because if you move, you're seen. And if you're seen, due to this drone warfare, you're hit. So Ukraine realized they couldn't just grind forward in the mud here.
And now we are seeing them shift their focus. They're going over the front lines to hit logistics and command posts and those oil refineries that are deep inside Russia.
Yeah, and I think that's incredibly smart. So you starve out the front line of supplies. You simultaneously hit Moscow's wallet by taking out their energy infrastructure. This limits the cash that they're getting from those rising global oil prices.
And it brings the reality of the war right to the Russian public. They're seeing the smoke, they're dealing with internet blackouts, and the economy is hurting. But the blowback for Ukrainian civilians has been devastating.
Yeah, when a military is stalled on the ground, they typically try to punish from the air. That's what we're seeing here. And we are actually seeing some of the heaviest, most sustained drone and missile bombardments on Ukrainian cities. That's to compensate for that frontline failure.
It's horrific. They're going after decision-making centers and even targeting a clearly marked UN humanitarian convoy. This feels like pure petty retaliation.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad you brought that up. This highlights why Ukraine's allies need to rethink their strategy right now. So sending traditional hardware, it's still critical, obviously, but the priorities need to shift.
In what way?
Well, the West needs to invest in electronic warfare and cyber tools. They should be helping Ukraine jam Russian networks before they can build these new ones. Keep them disconnected. Keep them paralyzed. But the window to do that is super tight right now. And that's because the environment is literally changing in real time. So spring is here, the leaves are back on the trees, and that foliage is going to give Russian infantry cover from all of those drones.
Which means the tactical game is about to reset again. We are out of the sludge of winter. Speaking of things resetting, if the Russian public is starting to really feel the domestic squeeze from those deep strikes and the failing economy, you've got to wonder where the breaking point actually is. I mean, Putin has insulated himself pretty well, but you just can't hide upwards of 350,000 casualties forever. I mean, eventually, that grief bleeds into everyday life in a way state TV just can't spin.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's because you can't propagandize away an empty chair at the dinner table. When you stack that localized grief on top of the very visible economic hits from those refinery strikes from Ukraine, the domestic pressure really starts compounding.
Right, especially when independent Russian outlets are the ones publishing those numbers now. It isn't just Western intelligence pointing it out anymore. But the flip side is that Ukraine is hurting too. I mean, they're looking at over 100,000 of their own people gone.
Yeah, then that's the grim calculus of this kind of war. So Ukraine is inflicting massive damage. They're taking out around 30,000 Russian troops a month right now. But Moscow has historically always been willing to just throw bodies at a problem until it goes away.
Which goes back to why those mid-range drone strikes are so vital. If Ukraine can't match Russia man for man, they have to make it impossible for those Russian soldiers to actually fight, eat, or even get basic orders.
That's the whole strategy, right? It's not about taking back every inch of territory tomorrow. It's about systemic degradation. You dismantle the Russian war machine from the inside out so that holding on to that land becomes incredibly toxic. It becomes an unsustainable burden for Moscow.
And the more unsustainable it gets, the more desperate the tactics become, which is a pattern that's been glaringly obvious on a different front. I'm obviously talking about the fallout from the U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran. This week seems like an inflection point. Between a ceasefire that's barely holding together and back-channel talks that seem to be spinning their wheels, the situation is completely up in the air.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And a lot of the weight of keeping that thread from snapping has landed squarely on Pakistan, right? They're trying to play peacemaker in a situation where nobody trusts anybody. Sounds familiar? Israel, Hamas, Israel, Hezbollah, Israel, Iran.
Right. Who's the common denominator in these things?
I'd have to, my math is no good, so I'd have to check what a denominator means. So, but look, that aside, the real shockwave this week actually didn't come from Islamabad. It came from Air Force One.
You must be referencing President Trump's recent comments about a potential 20-year freeze on Iran's nuclear program just to get a deal over the finish line. It's hard to overstate how much of a shift that is from the approach we saw during his first term.
Yeah, look, he literally pulled out of the 2015 Obama deal, the JCPOA, and specifically because of those sunset clauses. Now he's saying, look, 20 years is enough, as long as it's a real 20 years. And this just shows a fundamental pivot from demanding a permanent end to enrichment to just trying to put a lid on it until he, you know, goes the way of the buffalo.
Kicking the can down the road for the next generation to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely.
But is Tehran actually buying it? The Iranian foreign minister made it pretty clear they don't trust Washington's intentions right now. But honestly, who does trust Washington's intentions right now? Most people don't. They're deadlocked on the enriched material, so they're basically just stalling.
Yeah, I think what they're doing is postponing the hardest part here. You have to look at the pressure points. You've got Israel with Netanyahu saying the stockpile has to be totally wiped out before any war ends. So Trump's 20-year timeline puts Washington and Israel, the two biggest allies, on potentially very different pages.
And while they figure that out, the whole world is feeling the squeeze. Iran blocking the Strait of Hormuz is wrecking global supply chains and driving up oil prices, which probably explains why Trump was just in Beijing. More on that later in this episode. And he was talking to Xi Jinping about it.
Yeah, and it makes total sense when you look at China's stakes. Look, Beijing needs the strait to open for energy to flow. It's why they're pushing Pakistan so hard to step up its mediation game. But Pakistan is walking a tightrope right now.
They really are. Hosting back-channel talks is one thing, but then the U.S. media report drops claiming Pakistan let Iran park aircraft on their bases to hide them from American strikes. Islamabad basically tripped over itself, calling that fake news.
Yeah, and that's because that story destroys their credibility overnight. So a mediator can't afford to look like a shield for one side. So if they lean too close to Tehran, the U.S. and Israel begin bombing again. But if they look too cozy with the U.S., Iran just walks away.
So what is the reality of Pakistan's leverage here? Can they actually broker a deal, or are they just passing notes between two parties who completely distrust each other?
Yeah, I think that's the passing notes at this stage. So the core issues of sanctions, nuclear stockpiles, regional security, they're way out of Islamabad's weight class. Their real value is just keeping the lines of communication open so the ceasefire doesn't completely collapse.
Right. And if we're talking about who actually has the weight class to lean on Tehran, you have to look at Beijing. I told you guys we'd circle back to this. The optics here really makes Trump's trip to China this week so fascinating. I mean, just watching the footage of the summit, it felt less like a tense diplomatic negotiation and more like a massive victory lap.
Yeah, I think that you're right on the optics there. And just the visual alone of Trump and Xi together in China, it's been almost 10 years since we've seen that exact dynamic.
Exactly. And this time around, you had the marching bands, the red carpets, Trump getting that exclusive tour of the leadership compound. But I keep asking myself, what actually got done?
And that's the right question, because the summits with summits like this, the optics are always the message. So Xi rolled out that level of statecraft because both Washington and Beijing desperately need the world to think that things are stable right now. When you look for actual signed ink on the paper that doesn't matter, it's virtually empty.
Which is what I keep getting hung up on. Trump is out there talking about these fantastic trade deals, the airplanes, the agriculture, all of it. But then Beijing hasn't confirmed a single concrete purchase. It feels like we just pressed pause on the tension without actually solving anything.
Yeah, but, you know, some would assess pressing pause is actually the win in this situation. The victory wasn't securing a new trade deal. It was just avoiding a new trade war, or even worse, a ground war. That's why they set up this so-called Board of Trade. It basically just, it's just a pressure valve so they don't have to reopen the whole tariff nightmare from last year.
Okay, so that makes total sense when you look at who actually tagged along on this trip. Seeing guys like Elon Musk and Jensen Huang front and center, that definitely wasn't by accident. They have everything riding on this Chinese market.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely they do. Beijing desperately wants access to advanced tech, and the United States wants to keep an iron grip on that tech. Now, the fact that U.S. chip restrictions didn't blow up the summit, that tells you a lot here. Both leaders essentially agreed to just compartmentalize the really hard stuff.
But they definitely didn't compartmentalize Taiwan. I mean, Xi's language seemed unusually sharp this time around. He was explicitly warning about clashes and conflict if the U.S. mishandles the island.
Yeah, like Taiwan is the one red line Xi absolutely will not blur. We know this. The U.S. intelligence community knows this. Trump knows this. But Xi wanted this to be public. He was basically telling the United States, all this diplomacy only exists if you respect China's core claims over the island of Taiwan.
And that, of course, puts the U.S. in such a tight spot because Trump is sitting on that massive decision about a $14 billion arms sale to Taipei. But he's also trying to ride this fresh diplomatic high with Xi.
And you can see how Trump tried to leverage that newfound warmth to get China to move on other global crises. So the whole situation with the war in Iran and the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz was clearly hanging heavy in the room.
I kept wondering how much leverage he actually had. China buys so much of Iran's oil, and the blockade is obviously hurting everyone's bottom line. But Beijing didn't seem eager to play the heavy hand and force Tehran to end the conflict.
They aren't, and Beijing stuck right to its standard script about wanting peace and keeping shipping lanes open. There's a really interesting, subtle shift happening behind the scenes with global energy flows. Specifically, the idea of an energy swap where China buys more U.S. oil instead of Iranian crude oil. It's a reminder that while the public focuses on standard diplomatic talking points, the actual chess game here is being played in much more calculated, overlooked ways. So whether it's through oil tankers or actually a shifting military footprint.
And while everyone is watching those specific supply lines, there's a different kind of geographic realignment happening a bit further west that isn't getting nearly enough analytical attention. You look at the headlines, and it's easy to get caught up in the fact that a high-value target was taken out this weekend. But the real story here is the geography. If you ask the average person where the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda is operating, they're going to say Syria or Iraq.
Yeah, look, it's not just the average person either. Look, I'm seeing former analysts from various agencies who can't wrap their heads around the fact that those groups are being run financially and logistically in West Africa. That is a legacy mindset. The reality is that the center of gravity for global terrorism has aggressively shifted south. The fact that one of the top leaders of this entire global network wasn't hiding in a cave in the Levant, but in a compound in the Lake Chad Basin, that tells you everything about where this fight is actually happening right now.
So just to frame this for anyone catching up, U.S. and Nigerian forces just pulled off a major joint strike on a compound in the Lake Chad Basin. They killed Abu Bilal al-Manuki, which President Trump described as the global second-in-command for the Islamic State in a Truth Social post. They were also able to eliminate a bunch of his lieutenants. Manuki wasn't an import either. This is someone who came up through the ranks locally, tied to Boko Haram years ago, right? It's like these groups are just franchising the brand to local actors who already know the terrain, which is exactly what we saw play out over in Mali over the last few weeks.
Yeah, exactly. You nailed it exactly. It's a franchise model. You pledge allegiance to a global network, you get access to better funding channels, and a certain brutal prestige comes with that. So decapitating the leadership in Nigeria disrupts the actual command structure. But compare that to Mali, where we discussed how the local Al-Qaeda franchise, JNIM, assassinated the defense minister and has the government on the ropes. It's a tale of two totally different security environments. And what's fascinating to me, though, is the diplomatic whiplash.
Right, because just last Christmas, the U.S. was launching unilateral strikes in Nigeria because they felt the government wasn't protecting Christian communities from these exact militant groups. The relationship looked incredibly fractured.
It was, and that's where the pragmatism comes in. The U.S. realizes they can't effectively monitor the massive, swampy expanse of the Sahel without local intelligence. And Nigeria knows they need American assets, the reconnaissance, the precision strike capabilities to actually breach these fortified bases. So it's a marriage of necessity, especially when they look next door and see the Russian mercenary model failing.
Which makes sense when you look at President Tinubu's response. He basically had to defend working with Washington to his own people. He made this very blunt point that nobody can secure their country in isolation, sort of validating his foreign policy against the backdrop of Mali isolating itself with Moscow.
Yeah, I think this was a very shrewd but necessary political maneuver. Tinubu gets the win of eliminating a major threat, with zero recorded casualties on either side, both the U.S. and Nigeria, and he uses it to validate his alliances. He's telling a domestic audience that securing their borders requires playing ball with capable superpowers, the U.S., not Russian mercenaries who are taking massive casualties in Ukraine and abandoning towns in Mali like Kidal.
Look, taking out a top guy is obviously a win for the families who have been terrorized by him, but does a strike like this actually stabilize the region? I mean, with the poverty, the climate issues, shrinking Lake Chad, the root causes feeding these insurgencies haven't changed.
Yeah, you're spot on once again. And historically, a decapitation strike creates a dangerous short-term vacuum. So you might see rival factions like Boko Haram try to move in on that territory, or you might see a new lieutenant just step up and he wants to prove how ruthless he is by being ruthless. So the violence doesn't just evaporate, not to mention how JNIM's going to react to this in Mali. Al-Qaeda and ISIS aren't really the best of friends here.
I feel like this just morphs into whatever the next phase is. And if the state can't hold the territory once the dust settles, the extremists just rush right back in to fill the void, exactly like we saw in northern Mali. That makes me wonder how the other major players on the continent are going to react to this kind of U.S.-Nigerian alignment.
Now, there is a massive geopolitical fault line opening up right across West Africa. So on one side, you've got Nigeria and the coastal states, and they're doubling down on Western intelligence partnerships. And you have, on the other, you've got the Sahel, the juntas, those coups that have happened. They are essentially tied their entire survival to Moscow.
And the juntas have to be watching this successful strike in Nigeria and feeling just a tiny bit exposed. I mean, they expelled the American and French drone fleets to bring in Russian mercenaries. Now Russia is losing ground in Mali, while Nigeria is actually taking out high-value targets.
Yeah, and that's going to force those military governments to ask some really uncomfortable questions here. If the Africa Corps is abandoning towns like Kidal to triage their troop shortages in Ukraine, who protects the juntas when the insurgents inevitably push towards the capital?
Which is the terrifying part for the people actually living there, because when the mercenaries retreat, the state's military usually isn't equipped to hold the line alone. We've seen how quickly these extremist groups can overrun towns when they sense that weakness.
Yeah, look, they smell blood in the water right now. It's a textbook indicator that we look for in threat analysis. So when insurgents realize the state's security apparatus is hollowed out, they immediately transition from conducting rural ambushes to trying to hold and govern actual territory.
Which makes the U.S.-Nigeria partnership look like a necessary regional anchor right now. But it can't just be about dropping bombs. If Nigeria wants to truly secure the Lake Chad Basin, they have to rebuild these areas so the extremists don't just recruit the next generation of kids who feel forgotten.
And that is the billion-dollar problem here. The intelligence sharing and the kinetic strikes, that buys you time, but it doesn't buy you long-term peace. If the Nigerian government doesn't follow up this strike with actual governance, or services, and infrastructure, we're just hitting the reset button on the insurgency. Also, I do think the U.S. can play a role here by investing in tangible solutions for Nigeria, but also the Sahel here. We need to show that this isn't just a bunch of mercenaries who are recruiting bodies for the war in Ukraine, by the way. And that doesn't get enough media play. Russia is winning the information space here. The U.S. needs to show that it is truly invested in the prosperity of West Africa.
Kinetic action without governance is just an expensive band-aid, but frankly, I question whether the U.S. has the attention span, let alone the political capital, for that kind of deep generational investment in Africa right now, especially given the aggressively proactive posture they've suddenly adopted in our own hemisphere, because when you step back and look at the whole map right now, it really feels like the administration is just moving down a checklist. First, they actually go in and pull Maduro out of Venezuela, and now the crosshairs are locked directly on Havana.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening here. And taking Venezuela off the board was the prerequisite for this entire Cuba strategy. Havana relied heavily on Venezuelan oil to keep the lights on. So cutting the cord, that was step one.
Which brings us to the reality on the ground. And it's just, it's devastating. We're talking about near constant blackouts, people sitting in the dark for most of the day because the country has basically run out of fuel. It's hard to imagine living under that kind of daily strain.
And the strain is the intended mechanism here. The U.S. is essentially holding up a massive aid package with one hand. They're squeezing the economy with the other. The message delivered in Havana this week wasn't subtle. It's basically reform your political system. We're just going to let the collapse happen.
But is it just about economics anymore? Because floating this indictment against Raul Castro for a plane shootdown that happened decades ago, he's like 90-something years old. I mean, it feels different. It feels very personal.
It is. And when you game out an analysis of competing hypotheses here, you have to ask if the U.S. actually intends to send a strike team to arrest a retired leader, as you mentioned, in his 90s. That would look very bad. I hate to laugh there, but just the image of it, terrible. That's probably not what's going to happen. But as a psychological operation, it's a glaring warning to the Cuban elite.
Meaning, look what we just did in Caracas, and don't think we won't do it right here.
Yeah, exactly. So it isolates the leadership. The U.S. is trying to fracture the loyalists around the Castro family by showing them that the old guard is a liability, not a shield.
I guess my question is, what happens if this actually works too well? Like, if the government just completely buckles under the weight of the blockade and these legal threats, there's no safety net. We're looking at a state completely collapsing just off the coast of Florida.
That's the ultimate blind spot in a maximum pressure campaign. So you push for a breaking point, but you can't always control how it shatters. A total collapse in Havana almost guarantees a mass exodus, and suddenly a foreign policy maneuver turns into a massive domestic border crisis.
Which is exactly what local governments in the South are already bracing for. As you've just heard, the era of predictable, isolated crises is over. We're watching a simultaneous stress test of global stability across almost every continent. The tripwires are heavily laid. If Ukraine's campaign of systemic degradation pushes the Kremlin into a corner, the desperation we are seeing from Russian aerial bombardments could escalate in unpredictable ways. If the delicate back-channel diplomacy over Iran fails, the economic shockwaves of a blocked Strait of Hormuz will continue to wreck supply chains far beyond Beijing and Washington. And whether it's an extremist void forming in West Africa as Russian mercenaries retreat the Sahel, or a total societal collapse 90 miles off the coast of Florida resulting in a mass exodus, we're reminded that decapitation strikes and economic blockades are only the beginning. The real danger lies in what fills the vacuum. The coming weeks will reveal if these high-wire maneuvers successfully force adversaries into compliance or if they shatter these fragile systems completely. We'll be right here, checking the monitors and tracking every fracture. But before we sign off, is there anything else you would like to discuss?
I think I've said everything I need to say for this week. Do you have anything?
happy anniversary to us.
Yeah, I didn't know if you were going to talk about it, but yes.
Well, we don't have to talk about it. I was just wishing us happy anniversary. I mean, I've been putting up with you for 20 years. 20.
This is very true.
20. I'm just kidding. You've been putting up with me more.
And we've only been together for like 5 of those years. No. So.
I know. Does this year even count? I think we're starting
it
our
doesn't.
19th year. Yeah. And also fun. Well, never mind. Well, yeah, I can say that. Okay. Fun fact. 1 year ago today, exactly on the dot, Kirvin had to go somewhere else for work. So.
Yep. I thought you were going to say I left you.
You left
Kirvin me. Left me.
Kirvin left me. So we're actually starting our 19th year. So.
It has felt like we were dating this last year.
I know. Yeah. Like long distance dating.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
But that's changing soon.
That will soon change.
Yeah. Anyway. So congrats to us for making it through 20 years.
All those people who thought it wouldn't last. Joke's on
all
you.
Those, well, I don't know. I don't know if they thought it wouldn't last. I think they hoped it wouldn't last.
We were just petty enough to do it.
Anything for spite.
Yes. We don't even like each other. But
no.
by spite, all things are possible. So write that down.
We did it. But anyway, so yeah, thanks for marrying me and staying married to me. That's quite the feat. I don't think I've stuck to anything for 20 years. Oh, that's not true. I raised children. Okay. Okay.
You did.
That. I did that.
20 years of children raised.
20 years of children raised. Okay. I was about to say, like, I don't have the attention span to, like, or not even just about attention span. The focus, I guess that's tied into attention, but I just don't normally stick to things for that long. I get bored really easily. But you're not boring. You're fun.
I don't know if I'm fun, but I'm definitely not boring. The things I've put you through, for sure, not boring.
Anyways, guess we better move along, huh?
We can wrap this up for another year.
Yeah, but thank you for sticking with us, listeners. We appreciate you so much. And yeah, we'll see you next week, hopefully on the actual day that we're supposed to release these.
It's been busy, folks.
Yeah, it has been. It's trying to get the move going and everything. It's not easy.
Absolutely. And then look at the world around you.
Oh, look at the world around. I've been trying to avoid the world around me, so.
I get that.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to This Week Explained. We hope that you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear from you. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and more, be sure to follow us on social media at This Week Explained.
Tiana, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
Only at True North stores, new True Rewards members. Stack your savings at the pump. Sign up and earn 10 cents a gallon on your first fill-up. Second fill, get 20 cents off a gallon. Then earn a massive 30 cents off a gallon on your third fill-up. Join now. Find the True Rewards app in your favorite app store, download and click the star to sign up. Must be a new member of both True Rewards and Shell Fuel Rewards to qualify. Limit 20 gallons per fill. Additional terms apply. True North convenience stores. Fast, friendly, clean.